Welcome back to So How's That Going? I'm your host, Michelle Yamamoto. First, I'm excited to report that Colburn is presenting a new performance series beginning this coming February. I've gotten so many requests and questions about putting together a recital series to celebrate our incredible alumni, and this year it's come together. We're calling it our Next Up series, and the inaugural season will feature five programs submitted by alumni Ben Ullery, Conrad Jones, Eric Byers, Alicia Lee, and Maya Paredes. The first performance in the series will be on Saturday, February 13th, featuring Ben Ullery's program of Bach's Goldberg Variations for String Trio. The event is free with registration, and you can find all of the details at colburnschool.edu/nextup. One word, no spaces. Turning back to the task at hand, the podcast, in our last episode, we checked in on the state of things and heard some inspiring and groundbreaking perspectives from alumni Blake Laniscog, Andrew Brady, and Nakatula Nguyenyama. We also spoke with Jasmine Morales and the Center for Innovation and Community Impact here at Colburn. We covered everything from the pandemic to social justice issues to the state of the performing arts. And as we approach Black History Month and an historic moment in our country's history, I encourage you to take a listen or even a second listen. You can check it out on our website at colburnschool.edu/sohowsthatgoing. One word, no spaces. And of course, if you haven't yet, please subscribe on your platform of choice. That way you don't miss any updates and we get to keep in touch with you. We've got some extra episodes for you in the coming months and we wouldn't want you to miss out, so don't be shy, please subscribe. In this episode, we're going to hear from internationally renowned violinist and alumnus Anne Akiko Myers. Anne studied with Alice and Eleanor Schoenfeld at the Community School of Performing Arts up until 1983, when she went on to study violin performance at Indiana University at Bloomington and later at the Juilliard School. She has commissioned and collaborated widely with a diverse array of musicians, including those outside of the classical field, and is the recipient of the Avery Fisher Career Grant, the Distinguished Alumna Award from the Colburn School, the Luminary Award from the Pasadena Symphony, and is on the Advisory Council now for the American Youth Symphony. She spoke with us the first week of the new year about the year behind us, the year ahead of us, and her earliest days at Colburn. I'm just going to launch right into it because I feel like there's so much ground to cover. I was doing some research for this interview and I went, you know, the usual posts, your website, season announcements, press releases, and it seemed like 2020, as it was for many of us, was scheduled to be a pretty big year for you. You had a lot of things on the calendar. Can you talk about how your 2020 ended up?
Is that a trick question? It was quite an extraordinary year for all of us. And, you know, it started out very promisingly and I had many premieres scheduled. I was supposed to even perform the national anthem at Dodger Stadium, which I was greatly looking forward to.
Oh my gosh.
And I was going to premiere a new violin concerto by Arturo Marquez, a Mexican composer, with Gustavo Dudamel at the Hollywood Bowl. And I was also scheduled to premiere a new violin concerto about Amelia Earhart, written by Michael Doherty. And we were going to premiere that at the Kennedy Center. Like everybody else, I had my final concert beginning of March, completely unknowing that, you know, we were about to be on complete lockdown. And I performed a beautiful concerto by Adam Schoenberg in Memphis, and then came home and, you know, just went on full lockdown mode. It was just a lot of scrambling and trying to adapt and trying to figure out how to get my girls on Zoom for school and how to purchase groceries, how to do everything basically from scratch. And at the same time, you know, I was wondering and lamenting when life would come back to normal. I mean, like the comedian Jim Gaffigan, you know, he thought that it was going to last maybe 2 weeks, like spring break, we would all be back. And it just went on and on and on. And then you saw like the Titanic, everything just sink and continue to sink. And it became very bleak. You know, here we are in January, it's 9 months in, and I mean, it's incredible to think that there is a vaccination and that there's hope at the end of this tunnel. But it has created a lot of unease and anxiety and, you know, a hopelessness. And it forces you to recognize what is the most important thing to your personal existence. So that's a question that I think we've all been asking ourselves. And I am just very, very grateful that my family is healthy
and that we are all healthy. Yeah, it's been such a trying year, I think, for everybody generally, but I think especially for a lot of performing artists, it's, you know, you miss that sort of collaboration, that one-on-one, like you're having a conversation with the players around you. And I think that that's led to a lot of evaluation, I guess, of really life in a lot of ways, not to sound too dark about it. But yeah, I've heard from a lot of alums that have really struggled this past year, sort of coming to terms with what it means to be a performing artist in a time like this.
Well, when you're so conditioned and so used to expressing yourself, music is so incredibly powerful in that it transcends the written and spoken word. It creates emotion and mood and feeling without needing words. So when that is suddenly just severed from one's soul, you're just like completely, like I felt, you know, I was thrown through a black hole. I just didn't know if there was a bottom at all. I've watched many performers online adapt to this new reality and create concerts and try to just bring a connection into their living room. I think that's, you know, been so imperative for musicians to survive, because this is our life's work, but also it's our soul's language. It's so important that we are able to share our stories with the world.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely way of expressing it. You know, it's really the language of the soul. It's the way that musicians, artists, they communicate through their art.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you mentioned a lot of performing arts organizations and musicians and dancers as well have been really recalibrating and moving into virtual arenas where maybe they would never have dreamed they would end up. It sounds like maybe you have also done some of that in 2020. I think I'd read something about a New West performance, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you participated in that transition as well.
Well, that was a really fascinating event to take part in. Michael Christie, the conductor of the New West Symphony, had this beautiful idea to celebrate all the different cultures in the melting pot that makes up California. And so we started to create this program based around the Suzuki method and all the teachings of Dr. Suzuki and the music that he incorporated in his philosophy. I ended up playing a beautiful piece called Haru no Umi, or Sea in Spring, with a koto player. And I also performed the Bach double with Alyssa Park. She's the concert mistress of the New West Symphony. And it was just such a wonderful collaboration to be on stage, even though there was no audience, and to even hear the violins tuning again. You know, we greatly missed the woodwinds, but to keep them safe, you know, it was a string forward program. So, you know, it's concerts like that I've performed in. And another one that's coming up this weekend will feature a French program that I recorded on stage at the Wallace in Beverly Hills with the wonderful pianist Fabio Bedini. We recorded the Ravel Sonata and the Meditation from Thais, as well as Gounod's Ave Maria. You know, it's just like to be on stage, to put on your concert gown and perform for the cameras was still such a wonderful experience, because you realize like how important it is for people to still experience music. So I'm really looking forward to watching that program this weekend as well.
That sounds incredible. It's interesting that you pointed out the lack of the audience we've had. You know, a couple of students have actually mentioned that recording their performances is almost more daunting because they can't feed off of the audience, or they're sort of unsure what's at the other end of that lens. Mm-hmm. As a performer, what sort of preparation do you have to go through when you think about performing concert material in a concert setting, but without the audience there?
I think you have to treat it as just any performance that you're creating. It's, you know, without thinking so much of like, wow, this is reaching South America and Mexico and, oh, wow, Poland. Oh, there they are, which is really the global reach of the internet is just awesome. But, you know, you're just, you just have to be yourself. And I think a lot of students just have to let go of that fear and anxiety. I know that I just reach and go for it. I mean, there's nothing you can do but try your best. I always tell myself that.
Wise words, I would say. 2020, everyone went virtual. It sounds like you participated in that transition as well. And now that, you know, as you'd mentioned, a lot of performers and organizations are more accustomed to this virtual space, it seems for the moment like we may not be doing a lot of in-person right away, but we're sort of working in that direction. What's in store for you in 2021? And also, you know, what plans have you heard that seem to take advantage of this virtual, this greater reach, this sort of record from anywhere approach?
Well, I am a very project-driven person, and I always have been. And, you know, throughout this pandemic, I went through so many different phases of learning repertoire and going through my library and seeing what interested me, you know, just to play for the sake of playing and for one's own enjoyment without a deadline in place is a very different thing. But also at the same time, you know, I realized that I have so many ideas in mind that I really wanted to still move forward with. One of them is a recording project that I'm planning to do actually next week in La Jolla. We are going to this beautiful hall, the Conrad Theater there in La Jolla. And for the first time in my life, I will be recording remotely. You know, my producer and engineer will be in New York in their own studios while I'm on stage recording this whole anthology chronology of guitar violin music with the guitarist Jason Vio. It's things like that that I would have never thought in a million years that I would be doing. But I've created that project and I'm really looking forward to performing with a mask on stage with nobody there, you know? It gives me something to look forward to. I'm also playing another concert with Jason Vio from the Draylen Mason Studio in Austin's KMFA Studios, and that will be broadcast the end of January. And it's a celebration of this new, beautiful hall that they made in Austin, Texas. I'm just really taking every day, one day at a time. You know, we just still do not know when we can return to the concert hall and the stage. And I think at this point, just trying to give masterclasses, make a connection with your colleagues play online for patients. I mean,
absolutely.
Just whatever kinds of events that you can create will keep your passion and your motivation going to play music and to share your story. And that's, I think, it's so wonderful that a student during this time has the time to actually practice a lot and learn lots of different repertoire. But also, you know, making that connection is so important to one's development.
It's interesting also that you had mentioned performing in a mask. I feel like I read somewhere that it's so very different. I mean, even on violin, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be so affected by the presence of a mask, but it does affect a lot, especially if you rely on a lot of breath work for cueing or just take your own breaths with your own cueing. How has that transition been? And do you practice with a mask on if that's the case, if it's so very different?
You know, that's a good point. I never practice with a mask on because I can't stand wearing it. And it's almost impossible to play with a mask on. It just feels like it's choking me. I can't breathe well. You know, suddenly I feel like I need a root canal. Like there's pain in my mouth. Like I just feel like this, you know, like a blowfish, like, oh my God, you know, a puffer fish, like, I know the cameras are picking this up, like, you know, I'm just dying here on camera, but it's like, it's just a necessary evil to protect everyone from your breath as well. So it's just something we have to live with. I really have no words of wisdom there.
Well, luckily the mask hides a lot of the grimacing, I would assume.
Well, it hides a lot of grimacing. It hides also, you know, like I don't have to put on red lipstick.
Of course.
You know? I always love putting on red lipstick for the stage. So that's totally unnecessary with a mask.
It's more for your personal preference, I guess, that's normally how you prepare for it.
Yeah, you can just eat as many blueberries and blackberries as you want.
Lollipops, it's
and
all
no
there.
One yeah. will know.
I hadn't even thought about that, actually. That's hilarious. Oh, I love it. So this is, I mean, you know, it's interesting to hear about the way this has shifted for a lot of performers. And you know, especially you're a lifelong performer, of course. It also seems as though you're a lifelong supporter of the performing arts kind of generally. I was going through your website and you have a causes page. And I know that you've been very supportive of other organizations you've worked with. You've commissioned new works with composers. And I would love to hear more about your approach and philosophy around contributing to the fields as more than just a performer, but as sort of contributor, a supporter, a mentor, a teacher. Things like that.
Well, you know, music has nourished my soul and fed me my whole life. And so I feel such a wonderful embrace of the arts and what it has done for me and my family and the dreams that it's created. And, you know, all the teachers that have helped me along the way, one of them being Dick Colburn. You know, he was such a wonderful mentor and friend. And I was maybe 7, 8 years old when I started with Alice Schoenfeld and chamber music, also with her sister, Eleanor. And, you know, this very incredibly comprehensive foundation that was set here in Los Angeles, playing chamber music, having solo lessons, taking classes at the Colburn School, the community school then. That was really such a great time in my life. And when I was introduced to Dick Colburn, he made so many opportunities for me to perform at his beautiful home in Beverly Hills, but he also loaned violins to me. And even when I made the move to the Juilliard School, I took one of his violins with me. And it was so important in my development as an artist to be able to have an instrument to rely on. And I remember just the many wonderful memories where he would just say, Annie, here's a bunch of bows. And he was not kidding. I mean, he would put me in a room and I kid you not, it was like 10 of those 20 bow cases, you know, just like everywhere. And he's like, try them all, see what you like. You know, I'm like, what? Like, what else? Oh, like, are you kidding me?
It's like a kid in a candy store at that point.
Yeah, it was totally that. And it was just like, wow. His generosity was really amazing. And it just even in my late 20s, when I would give master classes, he was there at the master class and he would just talk to me like I was still 10 years old. Hey, Annie, how are you? And just really, really so sweet. There's so many people along the way that have been so generous and so helpful and assisted me in so many different ways. I'm just so grateful for that. So grateful.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're paying it forward a little bit with your support of those organizations. I think a colleague mentioned that you were also in the business of loaning violins to students that seemed to need that kind of support as well.
Well, I realize how important it is to have your voice. I've always relied on so many foundations and philanthropists to provide a violin for me. Even the current one that I perform on, the Vuitton Guarneri del Gesù, which is one of the most extraordinary violins in this world, is on a lifetime loan. And that kind of assurance, you know, that kind of stability to know that I am protecting this instrument and also responsible for it to go to the next generation of violinists is a great one. I've really seen throughout my entire life, the generosity is so, so crucial in implementing your dreams. So I'm a big believer in helping organizations, also donating violins, commissioning composers is really important part of my entire life and life's work. But just to see the growth from all these seeds gives me such delight.
Oh, yeah. The reward of that, I think, when you see something come to fruition or that you've supported something in someone else, it's really amazing. And
there's nothing like it.
Very glad that you're doing that for a number of musicians out there as well. I was very interested in reading about or reading your list of composers that you've commissioned works from. Do you have any particular criteria when you're working with composers, or is it very like project-based, like you say?
Each commissioning project really grows from a source that I can't predict. Everything is so different. You know, I've been really, really lucky to work with such talented composers, and I just have this natural awe of composers in general. So I just feel like I'm kind of almost bowing at their feet and their minds, just thinking always, you know, if I could go back in history, what would it be like if I could actually play for all these different titans in music? Like, would that inspire them to write something more for the violin if I was completely harassing them and being as tenacious as I am? You know, it just really always just takes a question. They can say no, but most of the time, it's really shocking to me that, you know, like the great Mexican composer, Arturo Marquez, we got together and he said, "Anne, I thank you so much for asking me to write this violin concerto because it has been bothering me for the last 25 years of my life. Like, I've wanted to write a concerto and it just have not been asked." And I almost just start crying when I hear something like that, because I've heard it many times from various composers. Like, I know Juhani Rautavaara, the great Finnish composer. He wrote his final work. You know, he didn't know at the time it was his final masterpiece, but it's so beautifully epic and reminds me of one of the pieces that, you know, I fell in love with his work originally. Like, it sounds very similar to that, the Arctus Canticus, the concerto for birds and orchestra. It's things like that. It's one after the other, these great, great composers like Arvo Pärt, who just shocked me when he sent me the Estonian lullaby and dedicated it to me.
Amazing.
And I was lucky enough to record it right before the shutdown. It was released last year. And then just currently, I had the idea of asking John Corigliano to write new cadenzas for the Beethoven violin concerto. I so expected him to say, absolutely not. And he was like, you know, the Beethoven violin concerto is the most important violin concerto. And it's one that I just hold in such great esteem. Like, that is the king concerto, you know, like, that is it. Let me think about this. I might actually do this one. And then he sent me the score just recently. And I was like, shaking, you know, like, oh, my God. Like, it's a collaboration for sure. But it's also just asking, you know, and finding the inspiration to ask. I mean, of course, I've been turned down by many, but so many great composers have been like, thank you for asking. And yes, I would love to do that. You know,
I've always said this, like, it really, you know, depending on the ask, but it doesn't hurt to ask. You know, someone could just say no, and that's the end of the conversation. But it could also be this moment of inspiration for the person that you're at. Like, they're going to actually contemplate what they're being asked, and that's going to lead to something great.
Yeah. And don't take no as no either. That's what I mean about being tenacious. Like, I was so tenacious with Morten Lauridsen. I pestered him to the ends of the earth. And I said, you know, I want something. I want a piece from you. And he's like, No, get in line. You know, I have like 5,000 commissions. I'm so busy. I can't and I won't. And then he came in here, heard me play the Vivaldi Four Seasons. And after that, he reluctantly said, you know, have you looked at my Omanium Mysterium piece? And he's like, that's the piece that I cry to. Literally, I cry every single time I listen to that stunning creation. And he's like, okay, I will arrange that for you. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's just mind blowing to me when things like that have happened.
Oh, I love it. I love that you were tenacious about it, because that payoff is huge.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I'm always curious about the performer-composer dynamic and then also the performer and student dynamic. So it's, I feel like you've really mastered both ends of that spectrum here.
Well, it's a relationship that it goes back a long time, but also I love creating and working with living composers, like, because I just always think if I could go back in time and visit with Chopin or Rachmaninoff, who would so, you know, just kick me to the curb. But, you know, like all these great, unbelievable composers, Ravel, Prokofiev, I mean, it just, the list goes on and on and on. And it's like, oh, you know, if I were there to pester them, what would have happened?
Right. You can pester these living composers now. It's perfect.
Exactly.
I mean, this is, you know, it's a living art, right? So I love that you are very committed to new works, you know, and not that there's not plenty of music out there that's already been written that is worth deep dives, but there's always something to be said about being part of that new guard, right? And putting your creative efforts into it, but also inspiring new creative efforts. I think that's so important to keep classical music fresh and alive and vibrant for so many people.
I mean, all music was new at one time.
Exactly. Yeah.
All of it. And a lot of the most incredibly iconic pieces were almost hated when they were premiered, which is just shocking. So when you think of that, you know, and how trends always are changing, you know, music is a constant.
Yes.
And it's also a reflection of the dialogue of the day.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's important to keep that fresh and alive and vital.
I could not agree with you more on that. I'm going to twist the conversation a little bit to turn back to your time at Colburn. So we have a sense of your experience there, because I'm very curious about it. It obviously predates the conservatory and I believe Music Academy as well. So I was reading a few different interviews of yours from recent years, and I read somewhere that you may have actually endured a 3.5-hour commute each way for lessons at one point in your life. Is that true?
It's true. Well, I endured, my mother put up with it. Yeah. I mean, go mom, right? It's just like, wow, the crazy things that all parents do for their children. And, you know, we are living in the middle of the desert in Ridgecrest, California.
Oh, wow.
The site of the 8.0s earthquakes, recent ones. And in order for me to have a lesson, we would pile up in the little VW Beetle and drive through the tundra of the Mojave Desert. 3.5 hours each way, yes, for a lesson, until I started studying seriously with Alice Schoenfeld. So that was quite an experience. And my mother tells me that, you know, we sadly hit a cow once.
No.
We were stuck in snow, like we were in black ice. We were, I mean, every kind of thing. And I would also practice VW. Bug. Yeah, it's just hard to fathom right now. But every time I see one in a garage or see an antique VW passing by, I'm just like, wow, how many.
That was my practice room.
That was it. That was the place to be.
I assume on like a half size violin and not.
Oh, it was even tinier back then. I think it was like, yeah, an eighth.
Otherwise, you couldn't possibly fit in the car, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So let me get this straight. So your mother would drive you for 3.5 hours each way,
mm-hmm.
and you would be practicing during that time?
I would practice in the car, yeah.
That says a lot about your mom.
Yes, and also not to throw my sister under the bus, but I am doing just that. You know, lots of times we would go for her violin lessons too. And we would, you know, I would be the one practicing in the car. And then we would get to the violin teacher's house and, oh, where's your violin, little sis? You know, oh, I forgot it. Whoopsies. So.
Oh my goodness. What a devastating moment that would be.
At least it was not me.
That right. Did that. Came out strong. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that would be so disappointing to get all that way and not have it. Would there be an extra? No one had a spare? Would you lend your violin?
No. Mine was like too big for her.
Fair enough. Oh my gosh. Well, that, how many years were you making that commute? That's a pretty, I mean, that's a day.
Yeah. I think we were doing that for about a year or so.
Okay. So it wasn't like 5 years that you were doing this every week, I assume.
Well, the big sacrifice that was made after that was that my father was on the West Coast running a university in Oregon, and my sister and my mother and I were all in New York City, you know, so I could attend the Juilliard School. So there's many, many sacrifices that were made. And, you know, you at that age, I was a teenager, just a little itty bitty teenager. Like, you really have no idea what the future holds. So that they made such a commitment like that was extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to, you know, what you were saying about supporting that next generation.
Yes.
And really, like, it's so many people along the way that make such a difference in this field, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that there's a level of dedication that we've heard from a lot of our Colburn family. I don't think I've heard of many, like, 3.5 hour commutes, but I've heard of, you know, Suzuki students that come to campus, like, 3 or 4 times a week. And if it's a big family and they have multiple students, you know, families are just there all the time, you know, and it's such an interesting transition now that we're virtual to think about how that changes the relationship with the school. And I was wondering if you had any words of advice for families that are sort of going through that transition right now. Of course, we're all very eager to get back to in-person instruction, but in this moment where we don't have, you know, long car rides and parents hanging out on the plaza, is there any words of encouragement, I guess, for families that are going through it right now?
Well, there's still so much information and so many streams and broadcasts and concerts one can attend online. And I think it's so important to keep feeding one's heart and soul with this music, with different videos. I mean, I have binge watched every single show, and I've watched so many things out there. It's really so important, I think, to always have your own personal space and to kind of clear the noise so you can apply yourself when you do practice, when you do listen to music, that you can appreciate that vital color that is so important in all of our lives and will be back. It will be back one day. We just all have to stay safe and hunker down right now.
I've seen the passion in the performing arts community. It will be back. I have no doubt about that.
It will be back.
Thank you so much for making time to speak with me about this crazy world that we're living in right now. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you, Michelle.
And that's our episode. Thank you so much to Annie Kiko Myers for taking time to speak with us and sharing your thoughts, regaling us with some great stories, and teaching us to never back down. I hope you were all inspired to think about the way you're writing history in your own lives, in your day-to-day interactions with others. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a friend that you think might enjoy it as well. The music in this episode is from Annie Kiko Myers' album, The Four Seasons, the Vivaldi album. You can learn more about the music, find shareable links, and subscribe to our podcast at colburnschool.edu/sohowsthatgoing. One word, no spaces. Layla J. Bishop is our producer and editor. Clara Huang is our web manager and back-end pro. I'm your host in the alumni office, Michelle Yamamoto. We wish you a wonderful day, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.